Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of. And we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and Scream.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid on Joy 94.9.
Welcome to tonight's show of Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9, and thanks to David and Jade from Different Strokes. That music piece we just heard was called In a Universe by Origa. And tonight's theme is anime, the films, the culture, the ghosts in the shell, the reviews of new anime films coming to Melbourne, the lowdown on the otaku, and just what is up with sex and anime, including queer sex. We also have a special guest with us this evening, Jim Morrissey, who's happy and willing to come on the show tonight to talk about his favourite animes and share in some of the reviews. I'll be doing a review on the horror film of the moment, The Human Centipede, later on in the evening. So I'm Sonia, and Kaz is here as well.
Hello.
And this is Sci-Fi and Scream, the only LGBTIQ science fiction and horror radio show on Australia's only LGBTIQ radio station, Joy 94.9. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream, Jim.
Well, nice to be here.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
You're good?
Yep.
Okay. And we're going to be talking about some of the anime films that are showing starting next week, commencing September the 2nd at Cinema Nova in Carlton. And Nova and Mad Men present Real Anime to 2010, showcasing five of the freshest anime feature films this side of Tokyo. So all films will be screened digitally and in their original Japanese with English subtitles, which I think is great.
Yep, absolutely.
Definitely. Now, the ones they'll be playing will be Evangelion 1.0. They'll also be playing Evangelion 2.0, Summer Wars, which I'll review a bit later, King of Fawn, which Jim and I will talk about later as well, and Kaz will talk about Red Line and Evangelion 2.0.
That's right. So, speaking of Evangelion 2.0, it's called You Cannot Advance.
Okay.
And to be honest, this is my first dipping of the toe into the whole Evangelion culture. Mm. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, puts me out of favour with a lot of hardcore anime fans, hardcore Evangelion fans. It's got a very big following. Mm. It's gone on for quite a long time now. But I'll try and give you a bit of a rundown on Evangelion 2.0. New EVA pilot Shinji is forced to live with experienced pilot Asuka, where his goofy but kind-hearted behaviour eventually has Asuka falling for him. But Shinji is attracted to the new pilot, Rei, who he slowly helps to open up, and she seems to be a very shy and sort of quiet person. Shinji meets a mysterious girl who speaks English, who we, the audience, are told is an EVA pilot. Now, the backdrop for the story is the war against the angels, which attack Japan, and so the EVA pilots defend Japan from these angels. Now, the three pilots work for NERV, and they're all forced together to work together to overcome the angels. But there's this sort of seething mass of political and religious plots underneath that are being devised. There's a character called Gendo who's preparing for a massive future event, sort of manipulating others and setting events in motion. Excuse me. Now, at one point in the film, Gendo goes on a trip to the moon to see one of these EVAs being built, and sort of sees his character, Kaworu, who becomes part of the story as well. Now, basically, as far as I could sort of synthesize, the story was about these angels and their power attacks on Japan. And you've got these sort of EVA pilots trying to fight them off. There's this thing called the dummy plug system, and basically, and I think you were talking about, Jim, that your understanding of it is young people fighting in these giant robot
battle suits.
Battle suits.
Things, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
And that was my general understanding of the film. I really did get quite confused at some points as to exactly what was going on. But it all seemed to be very action-packed, lots of sort of mysterious characters. I found it a little bit hard to keep track of everybody. Because I wasn't 100% sure if these were all new characters or not, I did struggle a little bit to keep track of all. Ugh, terrible cough tonight. Shouldn't even be gabbing on about Evangelion. I know so little about
angels
it.
Angels trying to get you.
Those angels are trying to kill me. So, you know, we see this sort of climax of the battle in Evangelion, and it really is fascinating. It looks amazing. What I got from the film itself, and look, I'm obviously apologising to any big Evangelion fans out there, because quite frankly, I found the whole thing a little bit confusing. What I did pick up from it was lots of action, a lot of violence, and a lot of sort of sexualised imagery of women as well, tied in with it all, which I know is a lot of people have made sort of comment that that happens a lot in Japanese animation, particularly it has this sort of subversive edge to it. I didn't think it was anything you hadn't seen before, but it definitely played a huge part in the feel of the film. There was also a lot of religious imagery. As I mentioned, there's that sort of religious subplot, but surprisingly Christian imagery and a lot of themes like that. I suppose that to the essence of Evangelion 2.0, like a lot of stories, it's about humanity's struggle against a big power or a greater power and the humanity's struggle to survive in any way that they can. It goes into this whole idea of sort of man-machine. So these young people who are in the battle suits are actually sort of physically and mentally, spiritually linked to these things. So there's this whole idea of a futuristic sort of melding of humanity and robot and machine. So, I mean, from a purely thematic and sort of imagery, symbolic side, really interesting. Fascinating.
Sounds very
thing
imaginative,
to watch.
Like
really imaginative.
Very innovative.
But it sort of has, again, has all those really interesting classic images, really classic stories, classic archetypes, with, I think, what is probably quite a typical Evangelion style. Again, the story, I have to go back and watch it again just to really get where they're going with it. And probably I might have to go back and see a fair bit beforehand as well. I tried to do a bit of research. There's nothing that says you can't watch this without a backstory, without knowing the backstory.
But it probably would help. Was it a manga originally? Is it a story?
To my knowledge, it was. I do know that it was the sort of forerunner, and people can certainly correct me on this, but my understanding of it, it was a forerunner of the big battle suit genre, because even in anime you've got different little subgenres.
Well, the look is really, it's the archetypal kind of battle suit that we've come to.
Like, Aliens, really, Avatar all have that battle suit thing.
Yeah, they,
this is better. Yeah,
well, they have a more fantastical approach. These are quite tall in comparison. But the style of them, because you probably have heard of a show called Robotech.
Robotech,
which had a different name in Japan when a company called Harmony Gold brought it out and changed it to what to the US, and sort of that was the first sort of one that crossed the boundary and was accepted as sort of that they had flying battle suits and everything. But even then, Evangelion ones, which I've just mispronounced, are huge by comparison. And as you were saying, as Kez was saying, is they tie in the whole, there's a spiritual link to it. And it's quite a big emphasis, and they can have these, as you were pointing out at the start, these sort of heartbreak high romances. At the same time, they're battling in these giant suits,
and I think that was a weird schism, and that's something that I found surprising, because I don't watch a lot of Japanese animation, so you know I'm quite new to it all. But I have read a little bit of manga, and it's something that I see is juxtaposed pretty frequently.
The coming-of-age story.
Sexuality. Really sexualized. Yeah. But these huge responsibilities placed on the shoulders of these teenagers, particularly in Evangelion. They're basically the last line of defense. And they, in a sense, have to... It's not only just a rite of passage in terms of growing up. It's a rite of passage in terms of, to an extent, sacrificing your humanity. And that's kind of what it seems like
to me. Where the Christian aspect comes in, which comes in, I think, for King of Fawn. I think so. Oh, we've got a message actually. That sounds like Jim. Oh, that sounds pretty hot. Jim, is he available? I'd like to hop into his battle suit. Well, I don't know if you have a battle suit. Jim, but look, if you've got a fan out there, you've got a fan already. That's brilliant.
We have never personally received a message like that before, Sonia. I'm a little bit hurt. And disappointed.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
So Sci-Fi and Squeam, we're looking at anime this evening. And we'll also be taking a look at Ghost in the Shell shortly after we have a bit of a track. Well, Jim is actually the person that has brought in a lot of these tracks because he certainly has got quite a collection, substantial collection of anime music.
Yeah.
Why do you collect it, Jim?
In this case, it was the music. I mean,
did the music get you first, or tracked you first, or was it the actual?
It was the combination.
Anime?
But
okay.
In these particular, all of these pieces, if anybody knows, will be coming either from the Ghost in the Shell movies,
mm-hmm.
Which was Ghost in the Shell, and then followed by Ghost in the Shell Innocence, or there was the TV series, which was called Standalone Complex. One and two. Yeah.
Was that played in Australia or?
No. These are all. No,
the TV series.
Ghost in the Shell came out in 1995, the movie,
right.
And that got a bit of a worldwide release, and that was a big deal.
Yes.
Crossing, once again, sort of the boundaries. It got, you know, international promotion. Standalone Complex was more, if you're a bit of a fan, you knew about it.
You can
definitely get it locally now. It's they're all a bit in the past now.
Okay, excellent. More of that soon. Sci-Fi and Squeam with Kaz and Sonia and Jim. And Jim is a fan of course, Ghosts in the Shell. Now,
That's
the film that came out in 1995 by your favourite director, I believe you told me earlier.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. To put it in context, Ghost in the Shell started off, and the purists will definitely, as a manga. In other words, as a printed book, magazine, whatever you like to call it. A gentleman with the surname of Shirao, which I'll pronounce safely, had a big following already. And then in 1995, they brought it to the big screen in the form of the movie just simply called Ghost in the Shell. Mm. And simply put, Ghost in the Shell, once again, this is going to tie nicely into what Kaz was saying, was it deals with, it focuses on what they would literally be translated as mobile armored riot police, or a particular department of a futuristic Japanese government in 2029.
Mm.
Neo Tokyo, and basically they deal with counterterrorism, and it gets quite complex from there. But it focuses on one character, Motoko Kusanagi, who is a woman who is basically 90% artificial body, and the ghost in the shell refers to the ghost is the human spirit within the shell, which are these various people with various augmented, you know, bodies with artificial
parts,
limbs
and bionic parts.
And it really deals with what is human. It goes into that sort of the complexity of that.
The ethical aspects too.
And then they nicely wrap it up with, I'm sort of jumping ahead here. The movie is a condensed version of a lot of events that happen in the manga. And then it then followed on with what was called Standalone Complex, which was a TV series, which was a bit more faithful in that it could spend a lot more time to the individual things. And they tackle through the story, they tackle a lot of issues like, the terrorism, what is human, the exploitation of, we make these things, we make artificial people and we abuse them, and who's the more human? You know, the sort of traditional themes. And then after that, they followed up more recently. I think the last effort was Ghost in the Shell Innocence, which was that music was from that. That was the end track.
Oh, yeah. Who was that by? Kimiko Ito.
I like the way you pronounce that. Yeah, much more better than I would. And that was another, beautiful to look at. Can be quite dense. And I'm going to say with Innocence, I actually, I found that I had a couple of viewings before I actually got them.
You got it. Yeah.
Yeah, because while a fan of the manga and the movies and that, I found that once again, Oishi, that's the Oishi-san, as they put the honorific son, he's the director that I also like.
Mamoru Oishi?
Yeah, Oishi. Yeah. Once again, please, anyone out there who knows the correct pronunciations.
I'm so sorry.
But it's a case of his style drew me because, as you probably know with anime, there's the big eyes, small mouth sort of style of drawing, which King of Thorn amply demonstrated, you know, where your eyes are half the size of your skull. And
based on Bambi, apparently. no, seriously. Yeah, looking back, Bambi was a very big influence. Walt Disney was a very big influence.
Yes, absolutely.
On the early anime. Yeah.
What I noticed with the Ghost in the Shell movies was the characters were more in proportion, and the style of art drew me into it initially. But that's all. Anyway.
That's why it's so advanced. I mean, people like, for example, James Cameron said it was an excellent, of its kind, the first most excellent type of anime.
They are going to do a live action.
Oh.
Really, they are going to do a live action.
Fantastic.
It's one of those things where I'm sort of cringing. If they do it well, it will be great. But otherwise, it will be straight to DVD, you know, in the $2 bin. But I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Completists will still buy it.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, of course. Yeah, that's true.
So compared to the one in 95 and, of course, Innocence, which came out in 2004, if a person was trying to, you know, get into these films,
I would, yeah.
Could they skip to just Innocence, 2004?
No, actually, I would say Innocence is a bit of an indulgence, actually. I would say, if anything, watch the 1995 one, because that is definitely the movie itself. It gets a bit complex. You see, the movie ends and takes the character in a certain direction. I don't want to spoil it.
No.
And it really does sort of cut off future storylines with that character in a way.
You mean the first one?
In the first one.
Yeah, I was quite taken aback, quite shocked. I won't spoil it, but what happens to that character?
So what then, later on, the people at, I think it was a studio called Production IG, they took over and they decided to do Standalone Complex, which...
Okay.
Was the same story, but because they were keeping more faithful to the actual book, it was drawn out over two seasons. And it basically, the movie Ghost in the Shell and its other movie, Ghost in the Shell Innocence, they're their own universe, and then you've got Standalone Complex. But anyway. But if you're going to get into it, I'd actually recommend getting into Standalone Complex.
Get into that first.
Yeah, I personally think that it's more fulfilling if you've got the time to watch the episodes, because it can take time. It develops the characters a lot stronger. You get a lot more wonderful music as well.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I might even look into that too when I get the time to do it.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now, I'm going to have another look at one of the films that's going to be playing at the Nova for the A Real Enemy Showcase. One of the five films from Tokyo, fresh from Tokyo, and that is King of Fawn. One of the quotes from the film is, "This world is somebody's wish fulfillment," and it might give away a little bit of it. King of Fawn is based on a science fiction manga series by the same name, created by Yuji Iwahara. The manga series was published between 2002 and 2005 in 6-bound volumes. This film adaptation is by the director Kazuyoshi Katayama and produced by the Kadokawa Picture Production House, which gave us Gamera many years ago, back in the 60s and 70s.
I love Gamera
too.
Good
times.
Gamera.
Because he was the rival against Godzilla. I don't think they ever fought each other. I'm not sure.
I always remember more the Mothra.
Mothra.
Gamera.
Mothra.
Yeah. Mothra Gamera. That was always mine.
If you can make a moth scary, they did it.
A flying turtle monster.
Yeah.
A giant moth.
A flying turtle monster as in Gamera.
I think it's a giant moth that shot out beams that blew up tanks too.
Yeah, I think that was.
Yeah. Laser.
Awesome. Yeah, it shot out a beam and it blew up lots of model tanks defending model Tokyo. So.
And some of the monsters that are designed in King of Fawn are amazing. The Demon Saws by Kenji Ando. And the theme song is by the Japanese pop star Misia, Edge of This World, which I quite liked that, but we don't have a copy of that. Apologies. Now, the story of the film goes in this sort of line. There's a pandemic on the loose, and it's called Medusa, the Medusa virus. And the first opening scene is quite stunning, with a woman falling to the earth off a skyscraper in downtown New York, of all places. She shatters into a pile of grey dust. And I did wonder if that was a reference to the Twin Towers. But anyway, it's very creepy and very effective. But apparently it's a virus that's run amok and called Medusa.
Yep, that's right.
So we've got a bit of European Greek mythology in there.
Yes.
And then we jump to somewhere in Scotland and an establishment called the Venus Gate. Now, at this time of part of the film, I'm getting confused.
That's all right.
Were you getting confused where we were going?
Yeah. It's set 2012 initially, and it shows the beginning of the virus, this Medusa. Virus.
Mm.
By 2015, we find out that as the people come to terms with this, it's 100% lethality, and it takes some time, but once you get it, there's no cure.
You dry up and you turn to stone. Yeah, it's not nice.
And this company, which has been investigated by various governments, offers a cryogenic solution by selecting a group of individuals.
160 of them.
160, to basically to go in to this remote, and quote, I think it was a heavily armoured fortress, which is an old castle in Scotland, of course. and where it turns out that the company is run by the former Russian interior minister. he gave up his...
I was getting confused.
Yeah, he gave up his lucrative job in the Russian interior ministry to head a company which I believe was backed by a doomsday cult.
Yeah. Wow, it's just like real life.
Yeah, I know. It's a bit like the election we've just had. And there's Alice. A-L-I-C-E.
The
sort of spells it out a bit later on, and she's in a hibernation state.
It's the computer system.
She's a computer system.
That's running and keep the people in their cryogenic stasis before a period of about 100 years where they hope to find a cure. Cure for the...
But they wake up earlier. Spoiler alert. They wake up a little earlier, don't they?
Yeah.
Out of their sleeping pods, only to be attacked by vicious bats of some
vicious
description.
Bats, and there's the very confusing briar thorns, the plant.
Demon sores, I thought they were.
No, demon sores, but then there's the actual plant material.
Oh, which is like a...
The Briar's Thorn.
Briar Thorn.
Is there a manga called Briar's Thorn or Briar Thorn? I think there is.
Yeah.
I've seen a series.
This is sort of related,
this one
I think.
Has a whole very heavy, as Sonia points out, the whole heavy Sleeping Beauty analogy.
Sleeping Beauty and Alice in Wonderland.
And in fact, one of the characters just basically quotes it from a book they're carrying of it.
Hmm.
And then they've chucked in this sort of... It's weird. That's why I began to get confused like you. It was a movie that, as I began to get into it, I thought, what an interesting premise. Are these people going to wake up? They're going to deal with this world where I assumed...
Because it was like a sci-fi, one of those sci-fi horror survivor movies.
Absolutely.
And we've seen it all before. It was a little bit like a cross between Avatar and Aliens. Avatar in the way that they're in another world.
Okay.
Sort of aspect.
Yes.
How do they adapt to that? But then they're all getting knocked off one by one, just like an alien.
Like an aliens, yes.
Idea.
When the other creatures appeared, I was really, really shocked, because I honestly thought it was going to be how these really assorted, because it focuses on a young Japanese girl.
Kasumi.
Mm.
Who's a twin.
Yep. And this mixed bag of individuals are chucked in. There's a convict, there's an Italian senator.
For some reason, there's an African-American.
African-American.
And we all know he gets it pretty early on.
First to go.
Like in any slasher or horror film. Hello.
I don't think he was first to go.
Well, you saw a different film, maybe.
Yes.
No, it is quite flawed, I think, with some of the storyline. But it's almost like two different films. So you've got the first part where they're like trying to survive and going up different levels to escape, aren't they, to find out why.
And even at that stage, I was still curious about the pandemic and seeing
how much time
it elapsed and what world was like with, I thought they were going to come across these tragic scenes of all these people and turned to stone or shattered into dust.
But then it sort of disappoints turning into this real fantastical...
It goes dream within a dream.
Yeah.
And I was almost able to say, have these people watched Inception? Because I was going, there's a lot of, she wakes up and it's a dream, and then wakes up. And anyway, I'm definitely, even though we're talking about it, don't feel at all that you're going to get
feel put off because
spoilers, because this is such a, what's the running time on it? Because seriously, I felt it went on for ages. I was really feeling it.
I think it's about 126 minutes. Let me just check that.
Yeah, it was heavy duty. It's
pretty long.
Make sure you sit down and have some time to think and to watch.
No, actually, 109. Beg your pardon? 109 minutes.
But it feels, doesn't it?
It is amazing to look at, though. It's a superb piece of animation.
Yeah, it had some great stuff in
and
it.
And it's on at the Nova. So, check it out, people.
Shoujo.
A young woman.
Shonen.
A young boy.
Bishoujo.
A pretty girl usually implies young, attractive, and sexually available.
Bishonen.
A beautiful boy, androgynous, effeminate.
Futanari.
A character that appears female but has male genitalia as well as breasts.
Ecchi.
Naughty or perverted, not sexually explicit, sometimes that is implied, includes sexual comedy, upskirt or panty shots, large bouncy but covered breasts, partial nudity, nipples, breasts and genitalia obscured by steam in a shower, for example, swimsuits, school uniforms. At worst, it can be called soft core.
Hentai.
Abnormal or perverted, sexually explicit, explicit nudity, sexual penetration, often with dildos, vibrators, tentacle sex with monsters, fetishes, especially bondage and torture, violence and hardcore.
Yuri.
Girls love lesbianism, can focus on sexual, spiritual and emotional aspects or relationships between female characters.
Yaoi.
A boy's love, homoerotic, homoromantic, can focus on sexual, spiritual, and emotional aspects of relationships between male characters.
Moe.
Denotes a turn-on or fetish for certain character traits. Example.
Meganeko moe.
Means attraction to someone, usually female, or who wears eyeglasses. And that was the lovely Tony Pittman from Reality Check, which is on Monday nights, helping me out with some Japanese pronunciation. And we're looking at sexuality now in anime. And I'd like to also offer a thanks to Chevron from Australia's very own LGBTIQ sci-fi fan club, Spaced Out. And he was the one who managed to get me those sexual definitions. Thanks for that, Chevron. Now, it doesn't matter that the range of sexuality subjects that there are in anime can be quite extreme. And we did have a track before that, didn't we? We had I Can't Be Cool.
Sorry, that was I Can't Be Cool.
Yeah. Laria Graziano.
Graziano. That's, again, that was from Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex.
Yep.
Sorry.
Love it.
Yep.
No, don't be sorry. Now, sexually, do they have the same taboos as we do, perhaps in European or Western culture, or should I say Judeo-Christian democracy of origins, for want of a better definition? And what right do people have to have an opinion to say that Japanese sexual practices that are shown in anime are hardcore or even softcore? As, for example, when the United States government occupied Japan after World War II, they did a lot to try and stamp out so-called immoral displays in Japanese culture. One story goes that it was prohibited to show the depiction of nipples and pubic hair in Japanese artwork. So erotica has always been a large part of Japanese culture. And so nudity and sexual acts are very common in erotic culture for Japan. And so in a way, it's sort of morphed into anime, so it's become a lot more, I should say, right across the board. We see a lot more of it in the film culture and in manga in particular. Now, as the definitions went before, shonen or boys in anime often that is treated not gender specific, but sometimes the sexuality boundaries are crossed and there's a lot of humor involved. There's a lot of cross dressing, which sometimes it's substituted when the author just wants to have a female molested, apparently. Now, Bishonen, as was mentioned, is a beautiful boy. Now, in Japanese culture, going back many centuries, often a Bishonen may have been a boy in a family, in a shogun family or samurai family, that was particularly more feminine than perhaps his siblings, and he often took on the role as a female within that family.
Yep.
There weren't as many females born, or perhaps they weren't allowed to survive, basically. So you had a lot of boys playing female roles, which comes across in anime. Lesbian characters are rather more common, but they're usually used as a device for making crude passes between female characters. That, too, is sort of like a titillation for male viewers, apparently. Now, shoujo, or girls' anime, is a lot more focused on relationships, and sometimes that's quite ambiguous. You can have platonic, strong, close platonic female relationships. And there are plenty of films out there, too, that have been around for a while. There's Revolutionary Girl Utena, which came out a few years ago, and that is probably one of the most popular anime with a lesbian theme. But it doesn't necessarily reflect the homosexual identity of the protagonists. It just means that perhaps a female character can take on the traits of a male character to show strength and a powerful position. So as far as it being, I don't know what you'd say, advanced in a Western sort of context, it's not necessarily the same in Japanese culture. And so historically, often, yeah, the gender roles are mixed up to substitute because of, you know, because of sexism and difficult gender roles, I guess.
Well,
that makes sense.
What you were saying, which is true, is that, with in the sort of 1700s and 1600s, it was there was a period of time, like the what they call the Edo period, where it was this whole entertainment, where we get the whole concept of geishas and so forth from. Well, that's where they were. There was this also that only males could impersonate females on
stage.
That's
right. Yep.
Because and that became an image that is translated across the even today, like you were saying, the effeminate-looking male or the sort of androgynous-looking male is a character that reappears and reappears in all sorts of anime. I've seen it.
Yeah.
They really distinguish the difference.
Definitely done a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, we're talking about anime, and that was a little bit about anime and sexuality in anime on Sci-Fi and Scream with Sonia, Kaz and Jim.
You are listening to Joy 94.9. It's Sci-Fi and Scream, and we're talking all things anime tonight. We have a special guest, Jim Morrissey, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Redline, which is one of the films that's going to show this year. Now, JP's biggest dream is to win the Redline, the galaxy's deadliest illegal road race, only held every 5 years at a secret location that's not unveiled until practically the last minute. In order to get there, JP needs to qualify by finishing in a ranked position in the yellow line race, something it looks like he'll have no problem doing, until his car mysteriously malfunctions and flips out just short of the finishing line. Waking up in hospital with a bunch of his bones shattered along with his dreams, JP is shocked to find that he has in fact made the grade. And it turns out that the venue has been announced. It's the fascist authoritarian military superpower state of Robo World. Why are they always fascist military? What the hell's going on in there?
Because Japan was a fascist military.
never forget. As a result, two of the races have dropped out, and it's not on particularly ideological grounds. It's more that they don't fancy being fired at while racing. It seems that the evil dictatorship that runs Robo World are not too keen on hosting the event and are already threatening to throw everything they have at stopping the races before the starting flag even drops. There's no real explanation as to why they decide to put it there.
Why is it called Robo World? Robo World. I mean, I don't know if I was a proud big fascist state, I would probably try and choose something a bit more.
I don't know. There is like a weird giant lizard thing that kind of mind melds with the Robo World's general vault. It's sort of like, again, a meld, like I mentioned in Evangelion, melding of biology and machine. So I suppose that's where the robo comes into it.
Bionic robos might have been better.
Bionic robos, bionic race of anyway. Redline has a really colourful cast of racers. There's, you know, a duo of nerds, this machine man sort of car hybrid who always sort of wins Redline. And then you've got the entire Robo World military that's desperate to stop the race with their secret weapons, like this massive orbital laser and all sorts of really cool stuff. So it's a really interesting story. There's not actually a lot to it when you think about it.
Did you find it more accessible than...
Far more accessible than Evangelion. Yep. Evangelion, look, I will admit I'm still thinking about it and I'm still struggling to get through it. Redline is visually amazing, really exciting, big mix of sort of different looking characters, influence and big sort of influences on the designs of the world. You can sort of see lots of different anime. It looks more traditional to me anyway. It looked like more of the sort of hand-drawn style.
Excellent.
The colours sometimes look like they'd just taken, you know, pots of paint and sort of thrown them at the screen. So really interesting, pretty frenzied. Like I mentioned, you know, it's Not big on story. You don't get a lot of explanations to why things are happening, but it looks fantastic. Really interesting sort of industrial soundtrack as well, sort of to keep in with the theme of the cars and the racing. So I actually really enjoyed this, besides the fact that it was a little bit confusing, not because it tried to explore any massive, huge themes. Mm. I think just because they really didn't maybe map out the story as well as they could have.
Meld.
Too many elements.
Very polite.
Too many meldings going on.
I like that.
And I'm not sure if this was just because we saw an advanced screening, obviously. You know, Sonia, we've been reviewing the films, but the subtitles were also a little bit
It's hard. Yeah, I was going to talk about that.
The Medusa was the interesting spelling of Medusa every time.
M-E-D-O-U.
Yeah, I was like Maldusa or something. Yeah,
that's why I got confused. I thought Medusa or Medusa.
Well, thankfully, they had an image up of Medusa, and then I realised, right.
Turned to stone. Yep.
Well, Redline was incredible fun, really amazing to watch. But again, hopefully before they screen it at the festival, they'll sort out the subtitle issues, that's what they are.
It's actually a big sort of fan thing that you can get.
Oh, yes.
Dare I speak about when you, maybe for those who access, you know, by not purchasing them from stores, if you get Japanese animation that hasn't never had a proper English sub, as they call it, English sub, these fans go to great lengths to make them accurate, and they actually blend them in with the graphics on the screen.
Oh,
they look very nice. Yeah, when you see one they spend a lot of time.
That's great.
Yeah, but it's just it is something for us who in Australia when you're trying to watch it with the subtitles, the poor spelling throws you out completely.
It does because I want to correct it.
Yeah, and the syntax and the sentences absolutely not right.
Exactly,
just doesn't scan. You're thinking about how to read it.
You're sitting there trying to go, what was he just trying to say? And you know,
and then you miss by the time you've tried to figure it out, you've missed what's happened next.
Exactly.
To the screen,
yeah,
so.
Yeah,
I know. It's not easy.
But I think it's really interesting, and I think it's one of those, maybe don't go see Evangeline 2.0 if you don't know what it's about, but Redline, definitely something that you can go into.
And you had a bit of fun.
Knowledge.
Ah, much fun the show is very icky hentai. Thank you. That's from one of our fans out there.
And SMS.
Thank you, Tony.
Getting very Japanese on the show.
I really love it. Japanese, and I think so. Now, Summer Wars is another one that's playing at the anime festival over at the Carlton, not the Carlton, the Nova, I should say.
Which is in Carlton. But.
Yeah. And it basically is about a creation of a virtual community called Oz. And it's made possible, it makes possible everyone to access it. It's accessible on the internet, of course, anywhere, anytime. And Kenji, who's a normal high school student, but he is a maths genius, so he's not that normal, he works part-time maintaining the Oz system. He falls for the girl of his dreams, Natsuki, and she invites him to accompany her back to Nagano, her hometown. When they arrive, Kenji is bewildered when Natsuki asks him to pretend to be her fiance. Although he's very young, because he's only like about 17, so that's interesting. He's a little bit bewildered, but they're there to celebrate the elderly grandmother's 90th birthday. Of course, it doesn't stay a happy birthday, because back in the world of Oz, in this virtual reality world, which the film is all about, a nasty virus, beastie I suppose you call it, has been hacked into the system called the Love Machine for some reason. It's called the Love Machine and it looks a little bit, it's not very lovable at all. It basically is like a lawless avatar that goes about taking out all the other avatars and inside that virtual reality world. And in the real world, of course, Kenji and Natsuki have to fight it.
Yep.
From the other side of the keyboard. That's what the film is about. It's got some fantastic animation in it, and it has, you know, got that, you know, kind of the same thing with the adolescent coming of age. He keeps having blood noses, which I looked up means sexual arousal whenever he's around Natsuki. So,
oh really? That's what a blood nose is.
A blood nose is
a Japanese,
sexual
a Japanese a cultural thing. Subtext thing for.
Does that put a few arousal. Things in perspective for you, does it, Jim?
Oh, yeah. Now I understand.
Now you get it. Okay.
Wow.
So that's Summer Wars, and that's one of the films that is playing at Real Anime, starting from the 2nd of September, which is only next week. So, yeah.
If you love anime, get there and check it out. I wonder if anyone's going to dress up for it. I'm excited to see if there's any cosplayers.
Yeah.
They had the Manifest last weekend, so there would have been a bit of cosplaying for that.
Yes, poor Manifest. People had to compete with the federal election again, I think. I think that happened to them
again. Wow, really?
In 2007 as well. Oh. So, Manifest, hopefully everyone enjoyed it.
Mm. Well, more enjoyable than the election.
Probably. Yeah, it's probably, at least someone won the cosplay
something
contest.
A result came about.
A hung cosplayer could be quite nice. Yeah.
No, don't even go. I've seen
tentacle sex. Perhaps.
Brings back horrible convention memories.
Oh. Well, I tell you what, Kaz, you can have your own show to do that.
You need more than one for disturbing convention moments.
I'm a whole season. We've had a few messages tonight, so that's nice. We even had an apology to you, Jim. Yes.
What's this?
I'd love to find out what other types of sci-fi Jim is into. I'm a huge Trekkie personally, a big fan, I guess that's what he means. And his favourite series is Voyager. Well, that's nice. And he thinks we're hot as well, Kaz. So
of course we are.
That's good. He can SMS again.
Okay, I'm going to just... I'm sorry.
Look, can pass on that.
Waste
you don't
people's
have
time.
To.
I'm not a fan of Voyager. That individual is taking up precious airtime.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. I will gladly say on air, I am not a fan of Voyager.
Well, shall I do it then? Shall I do Human Centipede?
Look, this is something that everyone would have heard of it by now, but Sonia, you've actually seen it.
Yeah. I've actually seen it. Sort of. Well. Now, The Human Centipede is directed by Tom Six, and yes, that is his real name. Now, it's called The Human Centipede, the first sequence, which obviously means there's going to be more, and there is going to be more. It's written and directed by Dutch filmmaker Tom Six, and it stars American, German, and a Japanese actor in the film. His previous films are Gay Movie, that was the name of it, Gay Movie, set in Amsterdam, and something called Honeys, also set in Amsterdam. But as Tom Six has been saying in interviews since the release of this film, it's his first foray into the genre of horror, which is something he's been wanting to do for some time. He's done a lot of light comedies, and now he wanted to have a crack at horror, so he's definitely gone head first into this. Well, while watching it the first time, and yes, I did have to attempt to watch it a few times, it's quite disjointed in manner, and that's not a play on words, not really. And, look, I won't go on about it too much, but... look, he does two things in this film, Tom. he presents a CV to the film world, especially the horror movie filmgoers, to say, look, I can do one of the creepiest concepts, apparently one of the most creepiest concepts that's been around for quite some time, and I can do it methodically with very few special effects. And shock the viewer, which is, I think, is what he's after.
Yep.
Okay. Secondly, perhaps he's also saying that I can put a spin on the old Frankenstein movie theme at the same time and turn it into a bit of a cult classic. I think he's hoping for that. Well, maybe that will be achieved. I'm not sure. But certainly there's been a lot of buzz around this particular horror film. It reminds me of Paranormal Activity as far as the buzz goes. And even the female lead, but she's not the lead, but I won't ruin that. She's a bit of the meat in the sandwich, you could say. She looks a lot like, and her name is Ashley C. Williams, she looks remarkably like the lead actress from Paranormal Activity, but it's not her, so it fooled me. Anyway, the plot is thus. Two female American tourists are lost in the German woods. I don't know if it's the Black Forest, but they're lost. And they're looking for a party. As you do.
I bet they found one.
They certainly did. Now, the girls abandon their car. That's the first silly thing they did.
Yep.
With a flat tire. They get all wet, of course. And they end up visiting Dr. Heater's house. Because he's the one with the light on
in
the house.
Is his house isolated? Next to the forest. Located in the forest.
Yeah, next to the forest, of course.
Excellent.
So I actually had the Rocky Horror Picture Show. What was that song called? There's a Light Over Frankenstein's Palace. But this is not a fun musical, not at all.
No.
Now, these wet girls turn up, and this German, ex-German surgeon is played with full-on creepiness by Dieter Lasser, who reminded me of Udo Kier, actually.
Oh!
So it was a little bit like Flesh for Frankenstein, Warhol's Flesh for Frankenstein, meets Blood for Dracula, meets... not quite sure.
Yeah. Oh,
Now, he has a seriously and profoundly disturbing fetish or desire, and that is to conjoin people. His previous job was to separate conjoined people.
Yes.
Now his love and passion is to join people. He did it with his German Rottweilers, but that failed. And now, after drugging these two innocent, young, attractive tourists, Americans, he drugs them with the rape jug, what is it, Rohypnol, and, of course, begins to play surgical fun time. He then gets a poor Japanese tourist who he darts with a and knocks him out and puts him in his Mercedes-Benz, and he becomes the lead of the attached three people. So we're looking at anus attached to mouth.
Yep.
Anus attached to mouth, six-legged, yep,
I've certainly
three
seen
people.
The, I've seen the trailer.
Have you seen the trailer?
I've seen the trailer, and I was just like, okay, there you go.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah.
He operates on their kneecaps so they can't run away, but I don't know how they could have anyway. And so that's the plot of the film. I'm not going to spoil it completely for you.
I don't know that there's anything you can spoil
that's
in
what
that
I was about
movie.
To say. And it's actually, I think you're doing a service to some people that might accidentally pick that up. If they're not ready to see conjoined people, it might not
well,
be...
Well, you know, the whole new... It's a whole new thing on that song. What is it called? People, People Eater. Really?
Oh, jeez.
Boom, boom. But...
Look, we've broached. Look, something we had to do.
We had to talk about it.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
And I think, like many of the reviews I've seen this week, most people just wanted to go away now.
The reviews I saw, they were one guy lasted about 10 minutes on it. He said it went 10 minutes too long.
Roger Ebert, who's the big film critic, you know, he says that, quote, "I'm required to award stars to movies I review. This time, I refuse to do it. The star rating system is unsuited to this film."
He should have given it a black hole.
Oh.
No, but I mean, you know, because it consumes stars instead, but also...
Thank you.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
I like that, Kaz. Okay.
I don't know where you were going, Sam.
You need to see the film. Is this movie good or is it bad? Does it matter? It is what it is, and it occupies a world where stars don't shine.
There you go.
Actually recommend it. I do, actually. I think people should.
No,
you do.
Just because you had to see it, everybody has to see it now.
Damn it. And it starts this Friday, the 27th. There are late sessions on at the Nova.
Can I just ask, because you had repeat viewings of it, did you come away with anything from
a bad
it?
Taste in my mouth, but...
Oh,
no. Seriously.
No, but was it genuine? No, I'm interested as well. No. Was there any actual cinematic value to
yes,
it?
Yes,
yeah,
there is.
There was.
There
yeah.
is.
Was the effects at least?
Yes, and the eye expressions from the actresses was pretty awesome.
I guess that would have to be.
Because I couldn't speak.
Yes, because that's, wow.
Look, we're going to have to leave it there. That's a wrap up.
Oh,
and,
there you go.
On that pleasant note.
And so ends another episode of Sci-Fi and Squeam. This time the genre was anime. We talked a little bit about classic anime with Jim Morrissey, and that was Ghost in the Shell, and also the Real Anime Festival that's on at the Nova starting next week. So thanks for coming in tonight, Jim.
Oh, thank you.
It's
both of you.
It's very, very interesting. Next week we will journey to the far out world of the Whedonverse and all things Joss Whedon, the genius creator of Buffy, Angel, Firefly, and that other one. Plus Kaz,
hey.
Kaz will rave Kaz will rave about Joss Whedon, who's talking this week at the Melbourne Writers Festival, and we'll also have some brown coats in the studio to share their love and the highlights from Can't Stop the Serenity, which is on this Saturday. Tickets are still available for that fundraiser. It's only on Sci-Fi and Squeam and only on Joy 94.9. Up next is Bandcamp with Adam Todd.
Sci-Fi and Squeam was synthesized and squashed into shape by Sonia, Albert and Kaz. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Squeam, or check out joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.